With these resources, Ashurnasirpal II was able to extend Assyrian control into the Taurus Mountains, up the northwest, and then also south to about the middle of the Euphrates River. This gave him an extensive center from which he could continue to pressure the regions west and south. Ashurnasirpal II led out his army on annual campaigns, during which he set and executed especially severe penalties for the peoples that he conquered. As a result, many potential rivals or enemies submitted to the Assyrians before they even attacked as a way to prevent widespread killing. His campaigns are described in the Assyrian Royal Annals, which document the annual deeds and accomplishments of Assyrian rulers. As we have done before, we must interpret these records with a view towards their original audience. Military successes dominate the royal annals, and as you might expect, the Assyrian ruler was always the victor in these official records, even if he had to adjust history to ensure this result. Not only was the king extraordinarily, we might even say suspiciously, successful in defeating his enemies, but he also tackled many logistical challenges to subdue them. And the fact that we'll see these Assyrian rulers talk about their feats of engineering in their official records of their reign indicates in another way the importance of the army and the military to the Assyrian culture. Instead of talking as frequently about building, the focus in these records is really on fighting and the success of the Assyrians in fighting. Ashurnasirpal, for example, crossed the Tigris by means of a bridge of rafts. The city was exceptionally difficult. It was surrounded by two walls. Its citadel had the form of a mountain peak. With the exalted strength of Ashur, my lord, with my massive troops, with my fierce battle, I fought them. I conquered the city. In another campaign, he sets out the equipment and engineering necessary to breach the walls of a city. He writes, "By the command of Ashur, the great lord, I besieged the city and conquered it by means of tunnels, battering rams, and siege towers." In addition to reporting the engineering feats and endurance of the Assyrian king and his army, the annals also set out the penalties that enemies of the Assyrian state would suffer. For example, one king writes, "I felled 300 of their combat troops with the sword and cut off their heads. I captured many soldiers alive. The rest of them I burnt. I built a pile of live men and of heads. I erected on stakes 700 soldiers before their gate. I razed, destroyed, and turned the city into ruin hills. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I flayed many right through my lands and draped their skin over the walls." This gives you a sense of the level of violence that we're going to encounter in Assyrian records, and we'll see that it is also set out in royal art. Just as in written records and reaching an even wider audience, these representations could cow potential enemies and bolster the king's reputation. We have thought about how defeated enemies are portrayed earlier in the course, and have seen that, for example, in Akkadian art, enemies are shown nude with their hands bound behind their backs, and this indicates their complete subjugation. So even within this cultural context, in which we see much more violent behavior than we're used to seeing, the artistic descriptions and the written records of the victims of Assyrian rulers can seem extreme. And this has often led to a view of Assyrian culture as exceptionally violent, cruel, and relentless. We will return to this complex topic when we examine Assyrian royal ideology. I can say now that the issue of the level of violence and what this indicates about Assyrian culture is unresolved. And it does lead to some interesting questions about the representations of brutality in ancient and modern societies and how they reflect cultural attitudes. We'll come back to this in a future lecture.